All right, so this episode of The Fire These Times, we're doing a special one, essentially on narratives around southern Lebanon, particularly about how it's undercovered and overlooked in international media, as well as parts of the country itself and the wider region. Until now, we've had over 80,000 people displaced as of today, which, according to my calendar, is January 19. More than, on my last count, 150 people have been killed. At least 25 of those are civilians, and 3 were journalists. So we brought today 2 very smart, intelligent researchers, academics, writers. They have many different talents between the two of them to discuss the situation in southern Lebanon and the wider narratives around that. So I'd like to first introduce Michel Aïd. If Michel, can you introduce yourself?
Yeah, so I'm Michel. I'm a researcher in socioeconomic rights, particularly agriculture, food sovereignty. And I'm also the editor-in-chief of a digital magazine called El Rawia, which focuses on a variety of topics in the Levant as well. I completed my bachelor's degree in the United States at the University of Toledo, and I graduated for my master's degree at Sciences Po in Paris in human rights and humanitarian action.
Thanks, Michelle. Good to have you with us. And also with us today is Karim Safiyadin. Karim, can you introduce yourself, please?
Hello. My name is Karim, as you already mentioned. I'm currently doing my PhD in sociology. I'm also someone who has worked in politics, grassroots politics in Lebanon for a while, since 2016, as I joined the Secular Club in AUB, and I'm a member of the MEDA Network, which is composed of secular clubs in different regions, sectors, and universities.
Great. Good to have you both with us today. So to start off, what we'd like to do is maybe give you guys some space to share any general thoughts about the ongoing war in Lebanon. Until now, you know, we might see a lack of news about this internationally, of course, but even locally. Life in Beirut, of course, is very different than what is happening in the South, or for those in the diaspora and abroad, or anyone watching Lebanon that's not in the affected areas. So I wanted to give the space, maybe Michel, you can start with us, just to kind of share any general impressions. Maybe you can talk to us a bit about what your life is like in Beirut versus the people that you know, are talking to, or the images and research that you're taking part in or seeing.
Okay, so I mean, I can sum this up firstly by saying the last few months have been like a state of being on airplane mode. I currently live in Jbeil, so I'm pretty far away from everything happening in the south. But my mother is actually from one of the villages being shelled, you know, every week or so, which is Dermimes. And I have a lot of family spread across other towns there. So I would say that I'm pretty lucky to be able to live here and to be able to see this from a faraway perspective, if you may. But it also is very weird that I get to live my life normally, where, you know, a huge portion of the country, the south, the bordering towns are not. And I don't know how to describe this other than being very, very weird, very dystopic, that, you know, 3/4 of the country are going on as normal, but the normal isn't really normal as well, you know? So everyone's just waiting for something to happen. Meanwhile, there are things that are happening in the south. There's destruction happening in the south. There's displacement. So it's a very weird atmosphere altogether. It's very weird to get to live and go on life as normal when people that you know or people who are close to you or even people that you don't know are experiencing very traumatic experiences. So it's really hard to truly describe how Lebanon is, like what Lebanon is currently going through, in simple terms at least.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's definitely like a sort of cognitive dissonance. Like you said, sitting in Jbeil or sitting in Beirut and seeing what's happening on the news. Karim, how about you? Any sort of reflections? You're with us today from the US, but you were here over the holiday period as well.
Right. I'm from the southern suburbs of Beirut as a resident. That's where I was for the past month. And we were able to directly hear and sense the Israeli strike in Dahiya when particular people were targeted there. And it's very clear that there is a very fearful discourse in the country, a very strict separation And part of that separation is this idea of looking at the south and the southern suburbs of Beirut as isolated cantons, and not even accounting for the huge humanitarian loss that we're witnessing and the environmental loss. 37 civilians till now have been killed, according to Lebanese security sources. You look at around 80 villages have been in total bombed since October 8. We're looking at a lot of displaced beneficiaries, a cumulative of around 6,000. In the past week, around 400. 80,000 people, more than 80,000 people displaced. Huge environmental damages to trees and forests and livestock and animals. And there is a very clear cumulative experience of destruction. And we can see that it's obviously, incomparable to what's happening in Gaza. But what we're seeing right now is a slow death process and a form of collective punishment that is supposed to install pressure by the Israelis to ensure submission in some sense of the term. And it's, of course, affecting the entire country. I mean, of course, the South is the most affected, but everyone is fearful of war. Everyone is thinking about leaving the country. Everyone is trying to find an escape. The Israelis, whether journalists or intellectuals or even officials, military officials, have directly threatened to bomb Beirut. And Beirut has been bombed. You know, the southern suburbs of Beirut is not an isolated canton. It is directly connected to the capital. It's directly connected to near neighbors of people from a variety of sects and backgrounds. So this is something that challenges us all, and we have to think about ways in which we can address the strict separation that's being created in the country currently, and it has to be addressed politically, not only socially or on a humanitarian basis.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up, Karim, particularly for those who don't know, on January 2nd, a member of Hamas who was responsible for the Al-Qassam Brigades in the West Bank, his name was Saleh Al-Aruri, was assassinated with a few other members, I believe, of the Jama'a Islamiyah in the southern suburbs of Beirut. It was a very, what I think people believe to have been a drone strike, though there were competing theories for a while, took him out and a few others. And, as you mentioned, Karim, the loud impact really shook the city, and there were fears of intensification and if that would continue. Obviously, it was a very targeted strike, very different from what we're seeing in Gaza and the destruction and catastrophic human loss and impact there. But as you mentioned as well, there's tons of people displaced in Lebanon at the moment. Particularly, people from the south have moved north. They've either stayed with families in places like Dahiyeh or the Metin area. Some people have just moved a bit further north and are staying in various centers. Michelle, can you talk to us a bit about your research in terms of what you've seen regarding this human impact in terms of the people who are displaced? And then feel free to kind of carry on from there into the other things that you're noticing and looking at.
Yeah, so essentially you've seen a displacement of a variety of different types of people coming from or living in the border towns. And that does include laborers as well who have worked in fields such as olive fields, tobacco fields, citrus fields. And so that brings me into another very pivotal point of this entire, war on the South and its ecocide, or the war on the environment and the ecology. So as we know, Israel has been using a variety of different types of shells to hit the South, some of which being artillery shells and white phosphorus or flare bombs, which are incendiary weapons, which has caused many to flee, not because of the burning effect, but also because of the other effects it has on, the air, the land, the water, the pollution. And a lot of green land and agricultural lands have been affected, have been hit. And if they haven't been hit, they have been affected by design by the toxic material that's been going into the air. So they weren't able to harvest their, let's say, olive harvests around November and late October, which is a big problem, because a lot of people who live in these lands are agricultural workers or work in these fields, or they make their living, their families make their living off of the olive harvests. And so a lot of that has been unsalvageable because they've been burned or they haven't been able to pick them. So during the truce, which happened, I believe, in November, and please correct me on the dates because I can't really remember at this point. It feels like
Yeah, it was the last week of November, and I believe it ended on December 1st.
Okay, so you had a lot of people who went back to tend to their lands, and they realized that a lot of the things there, a lot of the plants or the living, you know, trees, the shrubs, so on, were dead, or they were touched. So there was a group of farmers. I believe it was in Aita Shaab, but I'm not quite sure. I can't remember per se, but they had noticed that their crops of avocados have been hit. And so that was unsalvageable. And then when they tried to eat some of the cabbages that were seemingly unharmed, they felt, you know, they felt that something was wrong, and they were forced to be admitted to the hospital. So it shows that the civilians, how civilians are being impacted in the South. So it's not only through their livelihoods, but it's through their health, and it's through not being able to sustain themselves at all or live, be there at all. I'm sorry. Apart from that as well, I think another point that's very important to discuss is these people have been displaced. So some of them are staying with family, and some of them are trying to rent some apartments in either Beirut or in its suburbs and so on. And they've been faced with a problem of landlords raising their rents. A lot of them haven't been able to secure proper locations to live in because of this problem where their sorrows or the unfortunate situations they're in are being exploited. So yeah, I think people don't even discuss that as much or don't think of that as much either.
Yeah, and that's a really important problem that you mentioned. As Karim had mentioned, you know, these wider political problems, they manifest in very different ways. It can be through price gouging or people taking advantage or profiting off of other people's vulnerability or suffering. Karim, you know, you had mentioned, and you said something I really liked in your last statement here, that the southern suburbs are Beirut. And so I'm wondering, you know, how do you feel when you see these maybe wider discussions that happen in some pockets in Lebanon about people saying, listen, we don't want a war, or for example, maybe, you know, we're hoping the war doesn't come to us and hit us. But in a lot of ways, as you mentioned, it is hitting the country, and it's hit the southern suburbs. I'm wondering if you could speak to that a bit.
Yeah, definitely. Also a very important point on exploitation, rent, and control. I think we have to start with the important and rightful assumption that the government does not exist. The government is collapsing and has collapsed for the past 5 years. It was always in a precarious situation. Take 2006. The people that were on the ground helping those displaced were a bunch of volunteers across non-government organizations and new campaigns. You had a campaign called Slamidun in 2006, which grouped up leftists, Democrats, feminists, you know, people from a variety of backgrounds, political and otherwise. And they had to take up the burden of getting grants, getting funding, ensuring that these displaced people have shelter and providing food for them on a daily basis. So what we're seeing today is a government that has completely withdrawn from its responsibilities and is collapsing. And of course, when we say that's political, we believe that the forces that exist in this country and have managed this state and have co-opted this economy have, you know, led us to a catastrophic destruction in which community is completely being ignored and protection is being ignored. And that's related to the fact that we don't have an arm that is supposed to be monitoring the interests of marginalized groups in these contexts. Now, back to Dahiya and Beirut and the idea of war. I'm very sympathetic to people who say we don't want a war, and I believe that it is the responsibility of political actors, whether in the ruling class or alternative political actors, to provide something that is supposed to ensure not national unity, but a sense of understanding between social groups in this country. It's completely understandable that when people see the threats of Israelis and Israeli military officials on Twitter saying that they will bomb Beirut to oblivion, saying that no place in Lebanon is safe from our bombs, right? It's very clear that people don't want a war and also feel that they don't have control over the decision to escalate or de-escalate. So I'm sympathetic, but at the same time, the answer to this dilemma, the answer to this catastrophe on the level of our collapsed institutions. It's not separatism. It's not saying we don't want a war in our areas, go please bomb the other areas. And it's obviously not treating the southern suburbs of Beirut as if they're an island. You need to walk from Dahiya to get to Maram Khayr. It takes no time whatsoever. There is an intersection known as Knesset Maram Khayr that easily connects areas that are considered Christian majority and areas that are considered Shia majority. Within Dahiya, you have areas that are historically Christian and you have areas that are predominantly Shia. All of these are very well connected, and many of them have contradicting political allegiances. Of course, there is a very clear control, military control for Hezbollah on the general daily lives of people that live in most areas within Dahiya. But that does not mean that it is not connected to the city. It is extremely connected to the city, and people who live in Dahiya regularly go in and out of Dahiya, and people outside of Dahiya in Beirut regularly go in and out of Dahiya. So we're targeting Beirut because we're targeting everyone that is going in and out of the area and the urban space.
Yeah, I think you know what you say about Dahiya not being an island is very true, and I think we can extend that a bit and maybe even say, you know, I agree with your sensibility that, or with the sensibility that, you know, people do not want a war, or let's call it like a wider war that consumes the capital and consumes the rest of the country. But of course, you know, Dahiya is not an island. The South is not an island. And in a lot of ways, Lebanon is connected to the wider regional struggles, you know, in Palestine, in Syria, and beyond. So, Michelle, you know, you had brought up the use of things like white phosphorus. This is the thing that we've seen in Gaza. And Michelle, you shared an article a while back that I took note of, which was a Washington Post article from the 82 siege. So in a sense, we can see what's happening today in some ways. There is a connection to the region, but also to the past. So we can talk about, for example, the 82 siege of West Beirut and the Israeli invasion, ongoing occupation. We can also talk about 2006. Michelle, in some of your writing, you've connected what's happening today to the past. And I'm wondering if you can speak a bit about that work you did and kind of drawing these links to, or let me ask you, what does drawing these links show to you? And what do you think that can show to many of the people listening?
I can start this by saying, by looking at these previous conflicts that have happened, or the invasions, so 82, 92, 96, 2006, and now, you know, 2023/2024, and how Israel has, you know, conducted warfare, their tactics don't change in terms of how they target individuals, people, cities, so on. But their warfare becomes much more, you know, developed. To talk a little bit about my writing, I focused on the use of white phosphorus in the South, and I looked at how it affected the lands and the people and the agricultural sector in Lebanon. Because just to make this point very clear, you know, by Israel bombing Lebanon with white phosphorus, this doesn't only affect the South. It doesn't only affect the people of the South. It affects Lebanon's agriculture, Lebanon's economy, and, you know, the survival of its environment in the future. So it's safe to say that when Israel is conducting its raids, it's not thinking about short-term damage. It's also thinking about long-term damage. Even though there isn't as much research on how white phosphorus can affect for decades to come, the chemicals it releases into the land, or that it releases into the air, remain there. And so that means that these farmers whose lands have been affected are not going to be able to harvest like they've done before. The olive harvest is not going to be as fruitful as it was before. And these towns in the South, particularly near the border, they produce about 1/5 of the profit that Lebanon makes from the olive harvest when it exports. So imagine how that's going to affect our economy for the years to come. And very important note, our economy is already not healthy. So these hits that it's sustaining are not, you know, it's not going to make it any better. It's going to make it even worse. So Israel has used white phosphorus during its invasions in the past in Lebanon, particularly on the South, but also during the invasion of Beirut in 1982. But this is the first year that we've seen them use this as much, or target agriculture areas or green land as much. They've never done this in this intensity before, which comes to show that they are thinking about damaging the land long term. Even before, I think this is also something that would be interesting to talk about, is even before them using white phosphorus or before everything post October 7 started, they have taunted farmers in the South, you know, so they've always been a quote unquote a menace to agricultural workers and farmers in the South, whether it be through shooting cattle in the middle of the night for fun, whether it be destroying some of the land on the border so they can build even higher bordering walls. So all that to say is, looking historically and looking at it now, what these tactics show is them wanting to exert as much damage as possible, not only affecting, you know, their so-called military targets, but also affecting civilians and also affecting Lebanon's different sectors, whether it's the agriculture or the economy or the environment per se.
Karim, you know, you're a young and healthy man, as as we saw on the screen just before. You might not have lived to remember 82, and I know Michelle didn't, and neither have I, in fact, because I'm significantly younger than that. But you did live through 2006, though you were probably quite young at the time. Can you speak a bit about, you know, comparing that period until today and maybe some of your memories?
Yeah, I mean, 2006, I think there are two aspects to it. So we lived in Dahiya, and we had to move to Hamra and rented an apartment there alongside me and my cousins. And we were in the same apartment. And I was 8 years old, so I was very young. At first, we were never told that these are bombs, right? Our parents would tell us it's a storm, it's thunder. They'd make sure to tell us that, you know, there's nothing to fear. And after we went to Hamra, we were told that, yes, you know, there is a war. And the way we really imagined the war was very vivid as children, right? We don't know the conflict. We know that there's good and bad. We know that the Israelis are committing atrocities, and there are those resisting them. And to a large extent, this also mirrors the reality in Palestine. It mirrors the reality that many children go through as bombs are being put on their heads, right? And it produces an unending conflict. And the ways in which this violence is exerted creates a dynamic in which the conversation is completely depleted, particularly when we want to address the political resolution. We want to address the reality of rights. And we simply reproduce the cycle of violence. And this is something that the Israelis, I believe, understand, but have been using almost explicitly and strategically, is making sure that this is an unending conflict, making sure that the cycle of violence continues. Because that way, they can appropriate this reality and make sure to use that in favor of the status quo, which is unending land grab and environmental and human destruction, which is the case, of course, more seemingly and more obviously for the Israeli right. And we grow with this, right? We grow with this, and it really reinforces the political polarization that exists in the country. Because I lived in Dahiya, right? And to me, there was a political narrative that came with that, right? The political narrative of resistance and dignity. Other people lived in other places in the country, and they had different antagonists. They had different aggressors, right? The people who lived in Zahle in the 1980s under Assad Syria bombs had their own narrative. So I think it's very interesting, not only how Israeli bombardment and violence produces an unending conflict in favor of the status quo and land grab, but also how that violence has reproduced extremely strong political divisions in the country, which have hindered actual solidarity between people of different grievances and of different backgrounds. And I think that was what I've been increasingly alerted to as I've grown older and as I've remembered these memories and the way people have addressed them in discourse.
Karim, I'm going to stay with you for a second because I'd like to follow up with what you're saying. you know, if we talk about resistance in Lebanon, there's different narratives over time in terms of who was resisting who. And this particular space today has come to be, you know, for the sake of at least this podcast, we'll stick to this sort of time period or this dynamic here. The resistance space has come to be dominated by Hezbollah. So I'm wondering if you can speak about the lack of space for resistance made in the country due to Hezbollah coming to kind of dominate that space, and what that maybe looks like today in the current situation, whereby clearly there is an aggression happening on Lebanon and there is a wider feeling of wanting to oppose that, but also maybe not wanting to at the same time feed too much or let a group like Hezbollah that has been illiberal, that has, you know, committed crimes in Syria on behalf of the Assad regime, and of course domestically in Lebanon as well. So can you speak a bit to that, of like having to face this thing where, you know, the group dominating the space is not necessarily a group that you want to lend full solidarity to?
Yeah, that's in fact a constant dilemma, right? And it's something that is so almost unresolvable with, it feels so, of course, and I hope it's not, right? That's my unending hope, is that such forms of very violent polarization are resolvable and we can find solutions. And in fact, I believe October 17 was a popular solution. That when people said, you guys are the ruling regime, you guys are the civil war, and we're the popular revolution, people were saying, we want to go beyond the civil war. We want to go beyond the violence and the dichotomies that are produced by the civil war. We want to produce our own narrative. A comrade and a candidate from South Lebanon, his name was Ali Mrad. His name is Ali Mrad. He ran in the Bin Djibir district. He once had an episode on TV, and he said, we need to create a narrative. And I find that very interesting. And we also see that with, you know, other people talking about the importance of narrative creation throughout. And I hear this a lot from my comrades in MEDA too. And he characterized it with three sentences. We need to create a myth, right? The myth is, we all kicked out the Israelis in 2000. We all kicked out the Assad regime in 2005. And we all revolted against a corrupt ruling regime, neoliberal ruling regime in 2019. It's a myth, right? Different people did these things. And a lot of them hate each other. It's a catastrophic myth. But I think it's the way forward. The way forward is telling people that we had different aggressors and we had the agency to resist them. And this includes Hezbollah. It includes the Communist Party. It includes even right-wing political parties in 2005. It includes the secular democratic left in 2005. And it includes a wide range of anti-establishment actors since 2011. So I jump to the solution because I'm always afraid of prescribing a problem that feels so dense today. But yes, there is a dilemma, but people have tried to resolve it. And I believe the post-2019 era has allowed for avenues to resolve it. Today, it's very clear that there is a huge asymmetry between the technological capacity of a nuclear expansionist power like Israel and Hezbollah. Hezbollah boasts about its military capacity, and it is one of the most formidable militant groups in the region. But still, we cannot progress in terms of defense. We cannot progress in terms of protecting our people. We cannot progress in terms of making sure that the South is safe if we don't have a state that's supposed to protect its citizens, an advanced state, a state that invests in a society, that ensures technological progress, that actually brings us into the 21st century, which combats neoliberal policy and agendas and makes sure that marginalized groups are protected. This includes, for example, not polluting the Litani River. It also includes making sure that there is sustainable development for the South. It also includes making sure that people don't have to be displaced. They can go in bomb shelters, right? These are all things that we don't have because a state that is led by an alliance, which includes Hezbollah, has absolutely collapsed. And today we are left with a form of despotic division of labor between Hezbollah on one hand, and on the other hand, a very, in my opinion, wrongfully directed separatist movement that is implicit, right? You know, you don't have Sami Jbeir and Samir Jaja saying, we want to separate the country, right? And there are differences and nuances between these forces. But when someone like Samir Jaja says we shouldn't even pay compensation to those damaged in the South. And we shouldn't be paying our taxes in that direction. I mean, then we're acknowledging that we're not in one country, right? And that's catastrophic. And of course, Hezbollah does hold a lot of responsibility in leading us in that direction, definitely.
Yeah, I absolutely agree in that a lot of, maybe the direct talk is not in that direction, but you have maybe what we can say is coded language or dog whistles that essentially say things with the subtext, right? You know, a lot of this talk, one of the big things or one of the big terms that is often brought up is sovereignty. And I think that while, like you're saying, in a proper state, something like sovereignty is quite important, but sovereignty is one of those things that is thrown around quite a bit and abused, and the subtext is used in many different ways. When we talk about myths, I find that quite interesting as well, because I think you're right, Karim, that a lot of the big parties in Lebanon have developed their own myths, you know, with shades of truth within that. If we talk about the early days of the civil war, some of the Christian right would say things that they called themselves the original, you know, Lebanese resistance, where they were fighting the Palestinians, overlooking that there were many Lebanese elements in there as well, with their own sort of drives and desires and political desires for things to happen. Hezbollah, the same way, has kind of co-opted and filled this entire space of resistance against Israel, though, like you had mentioned, the Communist Party and others had long resisted against Israel before that. Michelle, you and I have talked, you know, we were at dinner the other week with our friend Hussein and Matt Nashid as well, and we discussed these spaces of resistance and trying to break down and think about resistance in a way, in a time where there's so many other things going on, and there, when you look at the Israeli narrative, having to again kind of look at this space and say that, you know, you don't want to take the side of an illiberal person like Assad, nor should you have to, but there's times where it feels like people are trying to put you into an either or box. And so I'm wondering if you can talk to a bit about how you've been thinking about this.
Well, this is a very tricky situation to be in, because I think you're bound to be put into a box or have the same opinion as someone you don't necessarily like. That being said, I don't think that should be something that's determining where you stand on something. So for example, you have a lot of people who think, okay, if the US is, let's say, anti, I don't know, any given situation, and they're usually anti-US, then they just stand against that opinion, not because of it, or they stand against the situation, not because it's right or wrong, but just because the US is against it. And the same goes for Iran, or the same goes for Saudi Arabia. For me, I haven't really let these different side factors really affect the way I think about things and affect my stance on Palestine and on a free Palestine. Even though, you know, when I'm sure everyone who has Twitter has seen the likes of, let's say, Jackson Hinkle on social media, or a lot of other people who are co-opting the Palestinian cause. I guess it's just, I think a major thing for me and for everyone around me and for everyone to be able to do is to stay informed on these different opinions or on these different people. So just because you see someone like Jackson Hinkle supporting Palestine, you don't have to scream, you know, Jackson Hinkle for president, or he's someone that I support.
Yeah, sorry, Michelle, your audio kind of bounced around a bit, but I think it should be okay. I think I got the gist. I like your belief, the thing that you just said, and I think that, you know, it really shouldn't be that complicated to be able to realize that you're not always going to agree with everybody in your camp on certain issues, and you absolutely should stand for something and not just against something. You know, despite the forces or the results of, you know, a certain international power, be that the United States, be that Iran, be that Russia, be that et cetera, simply standing in opposition on any and every issue, let's say, I think it is not a position that should be intellectually serious in a lot of ways. It should be an issue by issue sort of thing. Obviously, there are connections between things and opposing a wider power. But again, we have to look at, you know, the impacts on human beings and vulnerable people. And I think, you know, it's in the last few years, we've seen through a number of subjects, through a number of different international events, these sort of splits and rifts. And so standing up for something and believing in something rather than just taking opposition in such major things, be it Ukraine, be it Gaza, be it Palestine more generally, or internally in domestic politics, and also realizing that sometimes you might fall on the same side of one party that you disagree with on almost everything else, is okay, and can still take space to be critical or criticize that. Before I ramble on, I'd like to give us a little bit of space. I think that until now we've taken kind of an internal look here. I want to give us a little bit of space maybe to vent. Karim, obviously you're in the US. Michel, you and I have the I guess we could say the fortune to be in Lebanon at the moment, as we talked about it. It's considering everything that's happened post Tufan al-Aqsa and post October 7, the situation in Europe has been really tough for people who support Palestine and Arabs or Muslims more generally. But as well, you spent plenty of time in the US and were recently in France as well, as was I very briefly. So I'll start with you, Michel. Can you maybe speak a bit about what these sort of narratives that you've seen come out of Europe, seen come out of the West, and seen come out of the US? I'll give you the space to kind of vent a little bit. One I want to point to in particular, which I think I saw you comment on Twitter, there was a German journalist for, I think, some German tabloid, comment on the killing of two Mayadeen journalists in South Lebanon, essentially saying that he breathed a sigh of relief because they weren't real journalists. They were associated with Hezbollah. Regardless of Mayadeen's political outlook, I think we can all agree this is a problematic position to take for a lot of reasons. So I want to give everybody the space to kind of maybe vent a little bit right here. Karim, why don't you go ahead and we'll come back to Michel.
I mean, take this into account. There was a professor in Colombia, and he's a Zionist. I forgot the name. He's on Twitter, and he's rambling a lot about, you know, people who he considers pro-Hamas or pro-terror, all that. We have been witnessing, the way I see it, a complete omission of the Palestinian emancipatory narrative. I think that's what we're seeing, really. We're seeing that the Palestinian narrative for particular groups, states, geographies, for particular centers, for people that belong to particular ideological umbrellas, whether liberal or center or right-wing, the Palestinian narrative is omitted. What this means is that Palestinians who perform violence are different than Israelis who perform violence. Palestinians who commit crimes are different than Israelis who commit crimes. And what that leads to, what that leads to is suggesting that a particular, so I have a lot of ideological and coverage-based differences with Al-Mayadeen. But how is Al-Mayadeen different than many, many, many newspapers and outlets and television stations which have a clear bias towards the Israelis, which have a clear bias towards war crimes committed by the United States, a clear bias towards systems of power that exist in a variety of Western countries? How is Al-Mayadeen different than that? Just because Al-Mayadeen has a very clear bias towards the Assad regime and Iran, that does not mean that journalists who hold these biases become justified targets. But what we're really seeing is a polarized dichotomy that erases narratives and sustains other narratives. And what that really means is that particular humans' lives matter more than others because particular human stories matter more than others. And I believe Edward Said, you know, talked about this a lot as an intellectual living in the West, you know, about the need to sustain the Palestinian narrative. And I think that's where that comes from. I think the comments from that German journalist revolving around the killing of those two Al-Mayadeen news reporters, I believe that's exactly where it stems from. It stems from not seeing particular people as worthy of either emancipation or agency. And, you know, we see it all the time with how in the United States, groups that are considered pro-Hamas are banned, whatever that means, of course, because they're usually either very discreet or even not even supportive of Hamas. But they try to avoid the topic altogether and simply focus on Palestinian rights. But there are student groups in my university that openly and proudly say that they are collecting funds for the IDF and collecting volunteers for the IDF. It's insane. The idea that student groups that are considered pro-Hamas, between parentheses and quotations, of course, are banned while student groups that collect funds for an army that has murdered around 25,000, 26,000 human beings is supported, paraded, and proudly discussed, really tells you about what it means to be Palestinian or Arab in the West in this context today. And there's a huge responsibility for us to think about ways in which this narrative has to be put forth. And of course, this has to be done in solidarity, right, with a variety of communities. And it also requires that we be very smart and strategic about the way we voice these different opinions and stances that we hope to put forth.
Yeah, well said, Karim. I mean, as you mentioned, you can go around the campus and raise funds for the IDF, but BDS, the Boycott, Divest, and Sanction movement, which is a nonviolent movement, is banned in a number of U.S. states. There is a level of dehumanization, I think, as well as Arabs, Palestinians, more specifically Muslims as well. More generally, you know, there's and the intersections between these identities have felt in the West more generally. In France, briefly, we had the pro-Palestinian protests banned by the government. That was later overturned by the courts and has since kind of continued. But in Germany, it was much more extreme, and we're seeing a number of just news stories, one after the other, coming out, incredibly shocking, that are suppressing, you know, what we thought were these liberal spaces being able to speak and share opinions, and why, while they may still be for a number of issues and for a number of topics, you can still criticize the German government, for example. It seems harder and harder to criticize the Israeli government in such spaces. There's also, I'll point to one example, and I just saw the other day on Twitter, though I haven't looked too much into this, there was that U.S. Official, he worked in across numerous administrations in some way, there were viral videos emerged a couple months ago of him berating a food truck vendor in New York and essentially telling him very aggressive things, such as, you know, I'll send you to the Mukhabarat in Egypt and they'll pull out your family's fingernails, I believe he was caught saying. He was arrested, but he was recently let go and told he has to take a bias training, as though saying 24,000 Palestinian children, I think it was children, it may have been people, correct me if I'm wrong here, saying 24,000 dead Palestinians is not enough. I'm not sure that that's something that bias training can fix, but I think it speaks to a wider dehumanization. And anyone who I think has spent enough time in these societies will be able to tell you, and Karim, a lot of the points you made really speak to that, that there is a wider dehumanization. Some people say that there is a process of dehumanization going on. I grew up in the US and I feel, honestly, I'm not sure if Palestinians specifically, and more wider, these other identities that are kind of intersectional with Palestinians or aside Palestinians or allied with Palestinians, have ever truly been humanized in some ways. I think that people like this fellow who was arrested are maybe the face, you could say the extreme, and the sense of they're the face of it and saying it more broadly and boldly. But I do wonder how many of those sort of internal biases or feelings of discrimination exist and aren't expressed as explicitly. And I get the feeling that those things are structural, they're institutional, and they exist in individuals all over the place. And that's something quite difficult to deal with. Michelle, I think you're back with us now. I don't know if you want to jump in and add something here.
Yeah, I think something else that's really frustrated me, apart from the dehumanization, is the disinformation that we've witnessed throughout this entire situation and how easy it is for a lot of the Western audiences to believe misinformation and disinformation about Palestinians right away. But when they're presented with actual tellings or witness stories from Palestinians about what the IOF and Israel has conducted in Gaza and so on, they're a bit, you know, they're still a little bit weary about taking that information. And this reminds me of one time when there was this story that spread around about how Hamas apparently removed a baby out of a settler's stomach, or when they threw a baby into the oven. And then these were actually stories that come from real-time events of what the Israelis have done to Palestinians, whether it be in the Deir Yassin massacre 1948 when they forced a Palestinian baker to watch his own baby being thrown into an oven, or whether it's during the Sabra and Shatila massacre in 1982 when a pregnant woman's stomach was opened or was cut open and her fetus was removed out of there. So we've seen, I guess, with this rise of social media and how we've seen how important social media how important of a role it plays in the war. So it's not only a war on the ground, it's a war of disinformation, it's a technological war, it's an online war. And it just frustrates me to see Palestinian voices have to force themselves to, provide more evidence than anyone ever before. Meanwhile, Israelis or anyone who is Israeli adjacent can say whatever they want without really being fact-checked, as if to say, you know, Palestinian voices don't matter. And that's the reality of it for so many people out there, for so many audiences in the West, in Europe, in the US. Palestinian voices don't matter, and they can't seem to comprehend that Palestinians are humans just like them and just like anyone else, which goes back to the point of dehumanization.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a very prescient point. And I think, you know, sometimes as I think we've seen as this carries on, the information that is being shared is not about proving right from wrong. It's being used as a battering ram. And I think we've seen that particularly on the Israeli side, or when, you know, certain allies jump in and say, look at this particular instance or thing. And there have been a number of major talking points where there was a big kind of rush and rile up. And what I found interesting is that a lot of the times, you know, if such incidents happened, and some of these were proven false, but some of these were possible. And I'd rather not go into every single one at this moment. But I think there's still the open possibility of some of these accusations to be true or partially true. In a time of war, these sort of things tend to happen, not as an excuse, but it is a thing that happens. But rather than pointing them out to try to say, look, this was a thing that happened, we want to refer it to some sort of court of justice and see justice take part for this, it seems to me like a lot of these incidents have been put forward to kind of say, all right, this should be an excuse to allow us to continue this campaign of retribution and to continue to enact violence on Palestinians. And I think rather than take kind of a stance or a space of, you know, attacking civilians is wrong, or taking some sort of principled stance that is more general and can be applied universally, there is this sort of weighted stance of trying to use privilege and power to enact violence, which is something, Karim, you had kind of alluded to as well in regards to these tactics being used on various campuses. Before we go forward, I just want to give each of you, you know, a quick 1 minute to add anything in your heart that we haven't touched on just yet. And then I'm going to be asking you each to recommend three books as we do on each episode of The Fire These Times. Michelle, why don't you start first?
Okay, I guess something that's a little more positive, since we've been talking about so many heavy topics and conversations, I mean, heavy topics in the past, you know, hour, is seeing people united in these capital cities around the world has been insane for me to watch, to say the least. Or when I was in France for a month in November, and I was able to attend some of the protests there, they're not quite the same as the protests that you attend in Lebanon. I mean, that's quite obvious. That's normal. But it was nice to see so many people from so many different backgrounds come together for Palestine, chant together, hold signs together. And I think we, even though there's so much negative in the world at the moment, I think that's a positive thing to look at. And seeing how the world is standing for Palestine, maybe more than ever before, is something that we should hold on to and something that we should be hopeful about. And it's very important for us as people who are not living in Gaza at the moment to not lose hope, because if we lose hope, then what do we expect from people in Gaza to do, you know? So I think it's very important for us to keep on doing what we're doing, to keep resisting in any way that we can resist, and for everyone to not lose hope, I guess.
Yeah, that's a great point. Hope is radical, and it's something that we should keep. To your point about these protests in the West, I think, yeah, I really like that point, because I think it's an opportunity for a new pathway forward, introducing a lot of people to kind of internationalist politics and this kind of interconnectivity. I've heard some people express, you know, frustrations, let's say, that maybe this has happened in regards to Palestine, but didn't happen with other events in our region or more internationally. And the thing I try to maintain too, though, I share, you know, I share frustrations over some issues that haven't been, you know, properly supported politically or by certain parts of the left or activists in general in recent years. What I hope is that this is an opportunity for some people to find a new awareness. And so that when, you know, as we push forward, we can maybe turn back and look at other things that have happened in our region and lend support to what's happening in Sudan, for example, still to the ongoing struggle in Syria and other places. Karim, here's your minute. Go for it.
First of all, really, thanks a lot for this conversation. It was really enjoyable. And I think it's important to kind of synthesize these thoughts on a collective basis and more recurrently. On the idea of hope and radical action, take into account that while there is a worldwide global outreach over the genocide today, and in favor of Palestinian liberation today, particularly amongst university youth and radical spaces across the world, and a wide range of human beings who simply believe that there should be an end to all forms of settler colonization and all forms of apartheid and discrimination of any kind and forms of, you know, war crimes and violence that have been recurrently used in Palestine. This didn't exist, right? I mean, we see it today, but this was orchestrated. This was made into being. This became, right, in a very Gramscian sense of the term, political labor was being enforced by, you know, a small group of human beings across different capitals, across different cities, and even, you know, neighboring Palestine, not just in the West or in European countries. And I think that's important to mention, is that when Edward Said was alive in the 60s and 70s, when you had, you know, Rashid Khalidi just starting out, when you had activists, you know, starting out with BDS, you would be shunned to speak about the Palestinian cause, right? So a lot of work and effort was done in that direction. And we should uphold our responsibility to do so for a variety of causes across our region, right? And I think this sense of agency and responsibility is crucial and important, and it's no detail. So people who make comparisons, say, between Palestine and Syria, listen, I'm a zealot supporter of the Syrian revolution. I consider Bashar al-Assad, Iran, and Hezbollah some of the biggest obstacles to democracy and progress in our region. But there is a responsibility. There's a real responsibility on Lebanese and Syrians to actually make their voices heard, to actually think of a political narrative, to actually learn from their mistakes, to actually ensure that what is being said is persuasive and convincing, to actually build power, to make strategic alliances, to learn from some of the lessons and failures and successes of the Palestinian Intifada across different years and decades. And that's something we have to learn. We have to uphold our responsibility in that direction. And that's why I've become a bit sensitive to this idea that, you know, we deserve solidarity. We need to orchestrate solidarity. We need to orchestrate power. We need to be people who want to have an impact and footprint in this, on this world. To, on Lebanon specifically, and I would like to end on Lebanon just so we don't go very internationalist. What we say in the West does not apply to Lebanon, because Lebanon is enduring the war. Lebanon is under war. Lebanon has a particular history with the Palestinian cause. There are certain contradictions that exist in Lebanese society. The way we address conceptions of Zionism and collaboration in Lebanon is also extremely contested. And I say this all the time when addressing many of my leftist colleagues and comrades. Listen, Lebanon had two occupations. There was the Israeli Zionist occupation and there was the Syrian Assadist occupation. These both exist. These have different victims. These have different sources of grievance, and they also have different political responses. So the way we address conceptions of collaboration, dehumanization, conceptions of violence, even treason, these become far more heated and far more contested in the Lebanese landscape. And we have the responsibility to find a creative solution that upholds solidarity between different groups in the country. And we haven't reached that yet. We tried to, right? And, you know, for example, some students and youth in the Meta Network held a banner across bridges in Lebanon calling for a state, calling for holding Israeli crimes accountable and calling for a ceasefire. They were beaten by Hezbollah thugs in downtown, right? So it's very clear that solidarity, clear solidarity, is also being actively repressed. And we have a responsibility to think forward about ways in which this can be corrected for. And it's not easy.
Thank you guys for, first off, for your time and for these very provocative, thought-provoking final thoughts and hopeful reflections as we move forward in this space and as this war continues on and as we continue to watch what unfolds in our region. So to finalize and to end this episode, what I'm going to do is ask you each for 3 books to recommend. They can be on topic, but they don't have to be at all. 3 books that you just enjoyed or gave you hope. So Michelle, can you start us off?
Okay, I think the first book I would recommend is A House of Many Mansions by Kamal Saribi. It's a book essentially that fights certain myths that Lebanese people today may have about the history of the country, talking about things like the Phoenician identity, about Arab nationalism, about a bunch of different topics. I think people abroad, or people especially who care about Lebanon who live in Lebanon, would benefit from this book because of how it busts many myths that divide us today. Another book would be A'id ila Haifa, Return to Haifa by Ghassan Kanafani. I think that would be a book that would benefit a lot of people as well, just to understand what Palestinians went through in 1948, so many families with their kids, with their families, and how they were driven apart from each other. And also the third book is a bit technical, but it taught me a lot about Palestine per se. And it's Al-Miha al-Filastiniya min al-Saitara ila al-Dam, sorry. It's by Abdirrahman al-Tamimi, and it talks about water rights and how the occupation or the settler colonial state has barred Palestinians from their own water or from the water that comes out of their land. So yeah.
Thanks, Michelle. Karim?
So 3 books, Ta'amulat fi Shaqa' al-Arab by Samir Asir. It's called The Arab Malaise, or Being Arab in English. A very interesting book because it not only provides an interesting critique of the ways in which colonialism have manifested, but it also provides a critique of Arab self-responsibility and ways in which we can uphold our role in, you know, role in society and in the world. Al-Yasar al-Jadid, The New Left by Fawaz Trabulsi. It's a very new book, and it talks about the contradictions of the left in Lebanon and ways in which the new left emerged in the 70s and 80s as a post-Arab nationalist current. Also very interesting for people who want to learn more about the tactics and lessons that were made by these leftists, many of whom either became historians, sociologists, even liberals, and tried to kind of manage and navigate their expectations of what it means to have a just world. God, there's so many to pick from. There's a book called Fi al-Bahth 'an Mustaqbal by Karim Mrouwe. Karim Mrouwe is the former vice secretary general of the Lebanese Communist Party, big time leftist thinker and writer and teacher. He wrote a book called Fi al-Bahth 'an Mustaqbal, which also addresses ways in which democratic forces in the region have to reimagine their stances and opportunities. He died, if I'm not mistaken, 3 to 4 to 5 days ago. So it's very recent. And he was a big influence on many people within my camp.
Those are wonderful suggestions. And you guys have just given me a bunch of new stuff to read. Though I have read Being Arab many times and House of Many Mansions. And I'm trying, you guys might know, I'm not a native Arabic speaker. I've been on my journey in recent years. So A'id ila Haifa is on my bookshelf right now. And I'm trying to work my way through it. But I'm going to add these other ones as well. So thank you for that. All right. Thank you again to both Karim and Michelle for joining us. It was a great hour and some discussion with a lot to think about, some great book suggestions. And I think we finished on some positives and some hope. So thanks again to both of you.
Thank you. And thank you, Michelle. Really enjoyed the conversation.
Yeah, thank you, Justin. Thank you, Karim. This was really fun.